for the quantum mechanics part of the front end. And I want to finish off by discussing the concept of density matrices. But in order to put that into context, I'm first going to remind you of a lot of properties of state vectors. And I mean, we've been implicitly making use of these properties throughout the last few lectures anyway, but it's nice to just write them down a little bit formally. So let's first start off with state vectors. Okay, so isolated with any associated with any isolated physical system, we're going to have a complex vector space within a product. So in other words, a Hilbert space. And this is known as the state space of a system. So and then the system is completely described by its state vector, which can be represented by an object called a ket. And so we can shorten this by saying that kets live in Hilbert space. And you can think of this object as a column vector. And so a spanning set for a vector space is a set of vectors V1 all the way to Vn. So we can say it's a set of vectors V1 all the way to Vn, such that any vector, so such that any vector V can be written as a linear combination of these basis vectors. So for example, if we think of a two-level system, we can write down two vectors, 1, 0, and zero, one, and these form a spanning set for the two-dimensional Hilbert space. And that's because we can write any vector as a linear superposition of these two vectors. Now the spanning set isn't unique. We could have alternatively a different spanning set. We could have, so V1 is equal to normalized vector 1, 1, and V2 is equal to the orthogonal vector. And so in that case, we'd be able to write the vector V as a linear combination of these two vectors. Okay, great. Okay, we can define the dual vector to the state psi phi, and that can be represented by an object called a bra. And I'm sure you guys all know that if you put a bra and a ket together, you get a bracket. Which is, I guess, where the terminology comes from. So the dual is a linear operator from the inner product space V to the complex numbers C, and it's defined by the inner product. Like that. And the bras and kets are also related by the complex conjugate. Or, Hermitian conjugate. Which we denote by this dagger here. Okay, so for the state psi or phi to represent a physical state, we need this to be normalized. So we can define that in terms of bras and kets as well. So let's just consider an arbitrary two-level system. In general, the condition that psi is a unit vector is given by the inner product of the state being one, and that's known as the normalization condition. And you can see for the state here, the two-level system that we've defined, it ensures that that the probabilities add up to one. So we have a squared plus alpha squared plus beta squared is equal to one. Okay, we can also define evolution for state vectors. So the evolution for any closed system can just be described by unitary. And the unitary depends on the initial time and the final time that takes you from the initial system to the final, initial state to the final state. Okay, so that's all pretty standard. And now I want to just spend a little more time talking about projective measurements of state vectors. Okay, so projective measurements can be described by an observable, let's call it M. Where M is a Hermitian operator on the state space of the system that we're observing. And the observable M has a spectral decomposition, which we can write like this. And so we have a sum over a set of eigenvalues multiplied by the outer product of the eigenvectors. And so it's these objects here that we refer to as projectors. So we can say PM is the projector . Actually, I don't need to write that because we've got that written in math. But yeah, PM is the projector onto the eigenspace of M with the eigenvalue M of the observable. Okay, so after we perform a measurement on the state psi, then the probability of getting a measurement outcome. Can be calculated from the projector and the state. So the probability of getting outcome M is going to be given by the projector corresponding to that outcome sandwiched between the state psi and its dual. And given that M occurred, the state of the quantum system immediately after the measurement. Is going to be given by, so the state psi, the projector acting on the initial psi, and then we have to normalize by the probability of getting that measurement outcome. So I think most people are usually used to dealing with measuring expectation values of observables in quantum mechanics. And so this might be a slightly different formulation where we explicitly talk about the projectors. But you can make a connection between the expectation values and projective measurements simply from the definition of what we would expect, what the definition of an expectation value. So so for expectation values, let's say the expectation value of the observable M is just going to be the sum of the outcome times the probability of getting the outcome. And we know that that's given by this expression here. And then we can just move this sum inside past the bra. And then we know that that's actually the definition of the observable. So we find that the expression for calculating the expectation values of observables is just to sandwich them in between the state that we're looking at. And so when people talk about making measurements, sometimes they might just discuss the observable that they're wanting to measure, but other times they might just give you a list of the projectors that describe that particular measurement. So you can go one way or the other. And if somebody gives you a list of the projectors, then that just implies that the measurement that you're, the observable that you're measuring is decomposed like this. And so the projectors satisfy the following properties. That if you add them all together, you get the identity. And also the following property. I think the word for that is idempotent, but I never remember. Can someone confirm that? Idempotent? Is that what that means? Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. I always forget that. Okay. Great. Also, when talking about measurement, a common way for people to verbalize that is to say that we're measuring in a basis M. So what that means is that we're just measuring, doing a measurement described by projectors where, okay. So if your basis is M, then we're doing a measurement with a set of projectors defined by the outer product of the elements in the measurement basis. Okay, and so just like in terms of measurement, I wanted to give like one final like word of caution, is that we can't, like when talking about measurement, we can't say that we're measuring the projector PM, or like it's not a choice that we make. So like when you're doing an experiment and you're like setting something up to do a measurement, the thing that you choose is the observable that you're going to measure, but then the outcome, which corresponds to one particular PM, is something that happens randomly. So like we choose to measure M, but PM occurs with some probability. So don't like get confused and say, I'm going to measure a particular PM. Okay, so I want to say a couple of words about phase in quantum mechanics. I mean, so phase is a commonly used word, and it means different things depending on the context in which it's used. So I'll just bring up a couple of examples. So consider the state psi prime. So the terminology that people use is that they say that the state psi prime is equal to the state psi up to a global phase, e to the I, up to a global phase phi, theta. And the global phase or absolute phase is something that's not experimentally detectable. So we can check this, let's say, by calculating the probability of getting a particular outcome m. So let's say we got had a measurement outcome corresponding to the projector PM. That's going to be and you can see that this phase cancels out with that one, and so we're just going to get something that corresponds to the probability of getting the outcome for just this particular state here. So let's see, theta is called the global or absolute phase. On the other hand, we could have a superposition of two states. So we could write something like psi is equal to alpha 0 plus e to the I phi beta 1. And so here now we have a phase that represents how we're going to coherently add the state 0 and the state 1. And so this particular phase is called the relative phase. And phase. And depending on the measurement that we choose, it might be possible to actually experimentally measure this relative phase. So let's again calculate the probability of getting a particular outcome M. So here I'm just inserting the expression for psi on both sides, and then we can expand the brackets. Okay, so it's clear that this term comes from squaring that term. That term comes from squaring that term, so the phases cancel. And then we would get two more terms that are the cross products, but because they're just complex conjugates of each other, we can write it as two times the real part of one of those terms. And so this doesn't quite tell us anything yet, but if we consider two different types of measurement outcomes, so for example, if we were measuring in what's known as the computational basis, so in the 0, 1 basis, and we got an outcome corresponding to 0, then, so if we insert this into here, we see that it's going to be 0 for all of the terms, except for this one, where this thing becomes 1, and we're just left with a probability the alpha squared. So for this particular state, if we measure in the computational basis, we can't detect this relative phase. But now if we measure in a different basis, the plus-minus basis, and if we, let's say, get the outcome plus, then our projector will look like this. And then if we plug that in and calculate the probability, we'll get something that looks like this. And now you can see the probability of getting a particular outcome is going to depend on this relative phase phi. While in this case, no matter which measurement basis you choose, we can see that generally these phases are going to cancel out. Okay, so what happens if we've got more than one particle that we're interested in, or more than one system? So in quantum mechanics, we consider this by taking the tensor product of all of the different Hilbert spaces. So let's say I have a bunch of systems, numbered from 1 all the way to n, then the joint total state of the system is going to be given by something that looks like that. And so I've explicitly put the tensor products in here, but I mean, people use different types of shorthand notation to represent the tensor product. So you may see things like this. So people might just like drop the tensor product in between these cats, or they might just even combine them into one cat like that with a comma separating them. Sometimes you even see it written like this. So all of these things mean the same thing, but people just use different types of notation. And sometimes to be clear, people put labels on them. But sometimes they don't, so you just have to keep track of, you know, what's on the left and what's on the right. Okay, so far we've seen that in quantum mechanics, we can represent states in terms of superpositions of different state vectors. And if we have multiple particles, we have this tensor product structure. And those two things in combination naturally result in something that's known as entanglement. And so the easiest way to define entanglement is to just define it as to define not entanglement. So let's say, for example, if we can write a state of a, let's say, a bipartite system where you've got the two particles A and B, if you can write it as a tensor product of some state A and another state B, then this is called a separable state. Otherwise, it's entangled. And so entanglement is a really easy thing to define, but actually when you have some sort of arbitrary state, especially in higher dimensional systems, or if you have many entangled states, it's actually really non-trivial to, you know, calculate entanglement and, you know, determine the relative entanglement between different things. So this is a really like rich field of study, and a lot of people are looking into it. Okay, so let's just consider a few consequences of having this property of entanglement. So let's just look at a particular state. Let's say I have a state that is an equal coherent superposition of both particles being in the state zero, or both particles being in the state one. And now let's say that we keep particle A like on Earth and we send particle B like all the way to the moon or something. And assuming that there's no decoherence, that we can nicely isolate each individual particle from its environment, then even if this thing goes to the moon or to the other side of the Earth, the other side of the universe, we're still going to have entanglement between these two particles. And so now, let's say I choose to make a measurement on particle A on Earth. And let's say I'm going to measure in the computational bases and I get the outcome zero. So we're measuring in the 0, 1 bases. And we want to calculate what, let's say, we get the outcome zero, so let's calculate the state conditional on outcome zero. We do this by writing down the projector 0, 0 for particle A, and then that's tensored with the identity on particle B because we're not doing anything to particle B. And we act that on the original state, and then we normalize by the probability of getting outcome zero. And if you go through this calculation, you can see that the projector 0, 0 acting on state A in this term is going to make this term go to zero, but the projector acting on here is going to leave this term alone. And so the state that you're left with after normalization is a state that looks like this. And so what this means is that even though one of these particles is all the way on the moon, if I make a measurement here on my particle on Earth, and as soon as I make that measurement and get a measurement outcome, then the particle on the moon is instantaneously collapsed, I guess, into the state zero. And similarly, if you got the outcome one, then the particle on the moon is going to be projected into the state one. And so in both cases, you can see that after we make this measurement and we get an outcome, the states become separable. So now I can actually like think about the state, on Earth being completely separate from the state on the moon, but I've affected the state of the system on the moon. Okay, so you might be worried that if this sort of thing happens instantaneously, and if the particles are separated, like if they're on other sides of the universe, this might allow you to do faster than light communication. But fortunately, that's not the case, or unfortunately, depending on what your opinion is. But fortunately for Einstein, this doesn't happen because we don't choose the outcome 0 or 1. We just choose the basis in which we're measuring. But whether the outcome is 0 or 1 is something we don't have control over. So this just happens randomly. So even though like my state collapsed to zero and the state over there collapsed to zero, I didn't actually like communicate any information that way. It's just something that happened randomly. Okay, so now we know everything that there is to know about state vectors, and we can move on to density matrices. And so density matrices provide a convenient way to describing the quantum state of a system that's not completely known. So far, all of these states described by state vectors are states that we have maximal information about. Suppose that we have a quantum state in one of a number states, of states psi I with respective probabilities pi, then we can call pi psi I an ensemble of pure states. And then we can define the density matrix for this ensemble as rho is equal to the sum of the pure states weighted by the probability of having that particular state. Or we can say the probability of someone preparing that particular state. So this thing is known as a density operator. Sometimes people use the term density matrix, and many people, use it interchangeably. Really, if you wanted to write down a density matrix, you should, write down the matrix version of this, but nobody really cares about the terminology in practice. So for the density operator to be considered a physical state, it needs to satisfy two properties. So the first property is that the trace of the density matrix is equal to 1. So that's just the normalization condition to make sure that all of our probabilities sum to 1. And then the other one is that it's positive semi-definite. So an operator that's positive semi-definite means that all of its eigenvalues are non-negative. And it also implies that its Hermitian so that the Hermitian conjugate of the density matrix is equal to itself. Okay, so let's say we do know a state exactly. It has no uncertainty in what state it's in. Then the terminology that we use is that the state is pure. And if a state is pure, then the density operator is simply written as just the outer product of the state vectors. Otherwise, if it's not pure, then we use the terminology that it's mixed. And let's write that. Otherwise mixed. And there's a criterion that we can use to quantify how pure a state is, known as the purity. And so that's defined as the trace of the square of the density matrix. And so for a d-dimensional system, the purity ranges from 1 on d to 1. So a completely pure state is going to have a purity of 1. Let's say for a two-dimensional system, a qubit, the minimum purity that you can have is 1/2, which gives you a completely mixed state. Okay, so here we saw that the density matrix was decomposed into a set of eigenstates, and it might be tempting to assign some sort of special significance to these eigenstates. But like, we should be careful in doing things like that, because sometimes you can, you know, decompose the same matrix into, you know, a different set of eigenstates. So let's see an example of this. Okay, so let's say we have a density matrix that's a statistical mixture of the state 0 and the state 1. You might think that this actually means that someone in a lab prepared the state 0 with probability, you know, 3 on 2, and they prepared the state 1 with probability 1/4. Yes, well done. Yeah, they prepared it with probability 3 on 4. Whatever. Insert 3 and 4 in what I said before. But now if we consider, let's say if we define a different basis, for example, A is equal to a state like this, and B is equal to the orthogonal state. I'll lift this up in a second so you can see what I'm writing. So, I mean, we'll do this calculation in the tutorial as well, like go through the steps. Yeah. Oh, man. Very good. Okay. So, I mean, we could write it in the 0 and 1 basis, but that doesn't mean that that's actually how the state was prepared. Maybe somebody actually prepared, you know, the state A with probability 1/2 and the state B with probability 1/2. So you just have to be kind of careful about how you interpret the density matrix. We can also define evolution for the density matrix, which is just a very natural extension of what we had for the state vector. And we can also redefine our projective measurement in terms of density matrices. So the probability of getting outcome M is going to be given by the trace of the projector with the density matrix. And so you can convince yourself that if the state is pure, so then we have the probability is equal to the trace of the projector with the outer product of psi. And we just get the exactly the expression that we had before for pure states. Yes. Yeah, so in the Heisenberg picture, it wouldn't really matter whether you're dealing with density matrices or states, because you're just acting the unitary onto the operators rather than the states themselves, onto the observables, sorry. Okay, and we can also define the post-measurement state in a very analogous way. So given the outcome M, the post-measurement density matrix will be given by the projector acting on the initial density matrix from both sides, and then we normalize by the probability of getting the outcome M. And similarly, expectation values are also defined in terms of the trace. Okay, so that all kind of seems quite standard, but where density matrices really shine is when we start talking about the reduced density matrix of a larger Hilbert space or a larger bipartite system. So suppose we have, let's say, an entangled state of two systems like our two particles where we sent one of them off to the moon, then you might think that while they're entangled, you can't really talk about the state of, you know, one of the particles. But it turns out that we can do that if we calculate what's known as the partial trace over the system that we're not interested in, and then just look at the reduced density operator. So let's say we have our entangled state psi AB, then the density matrix for that state is going to be given by the outer product. And then the reduced density operator is defined by the partial trace. So we denote that by writing down the trace and then putting a subscript B for the state that we're tracing away, or like the information that we're throwing away about the other state. And so trace of B is a map of operators over the system B. And so we can define the partial trace further. So let's just write it out explicitly for a couple of one particular set of terms. So here we have an object that corresponds to particle A, and here we have an object that corresponds to particle B. And this isn't actually a state. I mean, it would be a state if A1 was equal to A2 and B1 was equal to B2. But we can just think of it as like one term and possibly like a bigger density matrix. And so if we want to calculate the partial trace over B for a term like this, we can rewrite that as just a trace over the system B. And then using the cyclic properties of the trace, we can write something like that. And so this is a really, really useful thing to know when you're calculating partial traces, which turns out to be something very easy to do in the in Dirac notation, is that whenever you have a system and you want to trace out part of the subsystem, you just take the bar and the ket and you swap them and then calculate the inner product. And so here, this term is just going to depend on the inner product of these guys. So let's just come back to our entangled state between Earth and the Moon, and we can calculate. We'll calculate the reduced density matrix of one of those of that particular state. So.
We can just extend that formula by linearity.
Exactly. Yep. So the density matrix for that was the outer product of the states, the state vectors. And then we can write that where is that state? I think I wrote it down wrong in my notes. Did I erase it? No, whatever. Okay, so we can just write out the density matrix like this. And so again, we've got the first thing depends on particle A, the second one is particle B, A, B. And just to make that more explicit, I'm going to split this up into a tensor product of the, you know, I guess we can say subcomponents of the density matrix. So I can say that's 0, 0 for particle A, tensored with 0, 0 for particle B, and so on.
The system has detected that a minimum number of lines are connected to this conference. Do you want to continue your meeting? Press 1 to confirm. If there is no response, the conference will end.
Yeah, so does this mean that one of the students is just like leaving?
I was about to say, I think yeah. The one who's Skyping every
bloody
time
hell.
Is just like, ah, I'm just doing this off.
I need to start doing cartwheels or something to keep them interested. Okay. Great. So we've written out our bipartite density matrix in terms of tensor products of system A and B. And so the trick that we learned just above was that if we want to trace out system B, we just flip the bra and the ket and then calculate the inner product. So let's do that. We have a half. Oh yeah, maybe I'll just point out if it isn't obvious. When people get lazy, rather than writing out the ket and the bra explicitly, people just like do a big X in the middle. So if that's confusing, that's all that's happening there. So now on system B, I've just swapped everything. And then because these states are orthogonal, this is going to be equal to 1. That's 0. That's 0. That's 1. And we get a density matrix that just describes system A. And we can see that if we were to calculate the purity for this state, it's going to be equal to a half, which means that it's a maximally mixed state. So that's kind of interesting that we start off with a completely pure bipartite state. But if we want to look at the reduced density matrix, if we want to just describe one of those states, it could potentially be completely mixed. Okay, so I mean, entanglement is, I mean, it can mean quite like a lot of different things that are not, you know, the community hasn't made precise yet. So I don't want to make any general statements, but just for pure states, which is what we wrote down here, an entangled state is something that cannot be written as a tensor product of two separate systems. So entanglement usually happens between different particles or different systems, but sometimes it can happen between different properties of one system. So for example, if I have a hydrogen atom with, you know, an electron, I can have entanglement between the energy level and the spin of the electron, even though it's, you know, just one system. So they're completely like separate properties. So entanglement is something that happens between different systems, while mixedness can be the property of just one system. Purity, I guess, represents how much information you have about a system. So you can have a completely entangled state that's pure, but you could also have a mixed state that has some entanglement. but they're kind of like different things. Okay. So, yeah.
There's like a relationship though that you're getting at here. Like there's some proposition that you're going to say it now. Like,
I think I'm going to say it, and you can tell me if what I was going to say. So I guess what you're trying to get at is that one way that people quantify the amount of entanglement between two systems is to calculate the how mixed one of the subsystems is. And so if you have two systems that are maximally entangled, then and they're pure, then the reduced density matrix will be maximally mixed. And so kind of, yeah. And so as, yeah, we can actually like write it down in a second. But let's say these things are maximally entangled, and then I'm tuning down the entanglement. I'm doing something that's making them unentangled, and eventually they're completely separable. Once they're completely separable, and I calculate the density matrix, reduced density matrix, that will be completely pure. So we can show that, like, for a separable bipartite state, then the reduced density matrix is like this. And we know that this is going to be equal to 1 because that state has to be normalized. And so then we're left with just the density matrix for system A. And we know that that's a pure state. I mean, we could calculate the purity. Well, let's just do it. We can calculate the purity and see that it's 1, so it's completely pure. But we can also just like look at it, because any state that can be just written as one term that's an outer product of a Brouwer and a Ket, like that's just by default pure. So is that what you were getting at, Dylan? Or was there something else we should add?
There might even be a converse too, right, that says if you have a
Right, yeah. So Joe will talk about this in the quantum theory course, but what you're referring to is the church of the larger Hilbert space. Pardon me? So I have a very poor memory and I get confused with the names of things, but I think what you're referring to is the equivalent of that for operations. But you could be right, like you could be referring to it for states. But, yeah, but you can do that for states or operations, and I'm not sure like if, but you probably remember better than I do. But in any case, so I guess the point that Dylan was trying to make is that at the beginning I introduced density matrices as a representation of a mixture of pure states, but really like you could always write down any density matrix. You could increase the Hilbert space and write it down as a pure state. So if you have a mixed state for one system, you can always write it as a pure entangled state of a larger Hilbert space. And so Joe will talk about that in more detail. But it's like kind of, well, no, I don't want to say anything about it. Let's stop with that. You know Sonali, right? Yeah, I think I understand where the confusion is coming from in terms of mixed and entangled. Because so whenever we deal with entangled systems, we have entanglement between two things. And when I wrote down the density matrix, I said the word ensemble, which may have suggested that there is more than one state. And so we're like, is that like how you interpreted it? That, or that there's more than one system, and we're looking at an ensemble of systems? Yeah, so you should think of it, yeah, as just one. So for a mixed state, it's just one system that could be prepared in many different states. But for entanglement, it's... Yeah, so that totally gets confusing. So for example, if I have something like 0, 0 plus 1, 1, and I'm like, this is an entangled state of system A and system B, I think naturally you think, oh, this is system A and this is system B. But you shouldn't think about it that way at all. Like you should think about the first guy is always A, second guy is B. First guy is A, second guy is B. But anyway, like in the tutorial, we'll go through like a bunch of these exercises. And I think the more you work with it yourself, the more it becomes obvious. Okie dokie. So yeah, so we've talked about density matrices and mixed states. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about measuring expectation values of density matrices and how that relates to measuring expectation values of pure states. So let's just look at this example density matrix I wrote down before. So let's define row one as this mixture of the state 0 and the state 1. And the word that that people often use is statistical mixture to make to represent this. And I mean, for this particular state, we could calculate the purity, and you would find that it's 5/8, so it's quite close to a half, like it's a pretty mixed state. And if we had many, many copies of this state, so if we were able to prepare one after another or prepare a lot of them at the same time, we'd be able to make a measurement on each one and build up the statistics and eventually get something that corresponds to the expectation value of a particular operator. So here I'm just going to talk about measuring expectation values of the Pauli matrices. So I'll remind you what they look like in bracket notation. Okay, and now let's just see what, let's use better notation. Let's see what happens if we calculate the expectation value of sigma z. So we saw before that the expectation value of an operator is defined as the trace of that operator and the density matrix that we're interested in. And so we can use the linearity of the trace to write down this. So in this case, I use the linearity of the trace. In this step, I use the cyclic properties of the trace. So that means that I can just like take this guy and swing it over on that side. And then I just have a number, so the trace operation disappears. And now if we plug this expression into what we have there, we see the thing that's sandwiched between 0, 0, we'll just pick that guy out. And the bit that's sandwiched between 1, 1, we'll pick that guy out. And we will get 3/4 minus 1/4, which is equal to 1/2. So that's great. We have the state. We go measure the expectation value of sigma z, and we get 1/2. But now let's compare that with a different type of state. So this state is now a coherent superposition of 0 and 1, as opposed to a statistical mixture of 0 and 1. But you can see that the probabilities for measuring 0 and 1 are going to be the same, because the probability for getting outcome 0 will be the square of this term, which is 3/4. The probability for getting outcome 1 will be the square of this term, which is 1/4. So if the probabilities of getting the outcomes of the eigenstates of the operator that we're measuring, if they're going to be the same, then the expectation value is also going to be the same. So I'm not going to calculate it because we're running out of time, but I will just tell you that now, if you wrote down the density matrix for this particular state and calculated the expectation value, you'd also get 1/2. So we have two completely different states. One state is pure and it's a coherent superposition. One state is almost completely mixed. It's a statistical mixture of these states. But if we measure the expectation value, we get something that's exactly the same. But quite clearly, these states are different, right? Like, so we would expect, if we're in a lab, we should be able to do something to distinguish between them. And so what you have to do is you have to cleverly choose your basis. And rather than measuring in sigma z, you could, for example, measure in sigma x. So let's just see what happens if we measure in the sigma x basis. So we do the same thing. We use the linearity of the trace and then the cyclic properties of the trace. And then if we plug in our expression for row 1, we get 0 plus 0 is equal to 0. Now for row 2, we will get. A number that's not zero. So that's nice. As we would expect, these states are different, so there should be something that we can do in a lab that's going to distinguish between them. And here, if we measure in the sigma x basis, the result we get for the mixed state, yes? Yeah. Very good. If we measure row one in the sigma x basis, we get something that's equal to zero. If we measure row two in the sigma x basis, we get root three on two. So that's good. Yes, Ben.
I just wanted to compare this to what we did before, all the way on the right of the second board over there. This psi is kind of like, it is the state that we called A before.
What are we referring? Oh, has it been erased? Or?
No, it's on the right.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And before we compared a state that was 3/4 zero, a statistical mixture of 0 and 1 versus a state that was a statistical mixture of these other two, states, and we found that they had the same density matrix, right?
Right.
Is there anything that we could do that would distinguish those?
You want to see if you can distinguish this state from the state above there? So that's a statistical mixture of 0 and 1, and that's
exactly.
Those
are the same density matrix.
Completely indistinguishable, yeah. So
completely indistinguishable, what does it mean to say that any particle coming in is really in the state?
It doesn't mean, yeah, so you, yeah, yeah. So the point is that you need to be careful. You shouldn't assign some sort of special significance to 0 and 1 just because you can diagonalize it and get the eigenstate 0 and 1.
You can only do that if you know which state you have prepared the...
If you have some a priori information that somebody tells you that you've prepared it that way, you can think about it that way. But if you just get some system and you... So in a second, I will talk to you about how you can reconstruct the complete density matrix. So if you were to go through a procedure where you experimentally reconstruct the complete density matrix, you can't tell the difference between someone who created a, was giving you 0 and 1 with some probability, or someone who was giving you the state A and B with, some sort of probabilities. And on top of that, you can't tell the difference between this or if somebody actually created a pure state of two entangled particles and was just sending you one of those guys over and over again. And you were just doing, measurements on like one of the subsystems. You couldn't even tell the difference between that state and a state that was unentangled but mixed. So that's a really good point that you brought up. Just very finally. So we saw that we can calculate the expectation value of, let's say, sigma z. We can calculate the expectation value of sigma x, and those both correspond to experiments that we can make in the lab. But neither of those really characterize the everything that we know about the state. And so ultimately, what we would like to do is to reconstruct the entire density matrix, because that represents all of the information that we have about a particular quantum system. Okay, so it turns out that I can just, like any density matrix I have, I can decompose it into any orthogonal basis. So if we, into a linear superposition of operators that span the Hilbert space. So for, let's say, a two-dimensional system, I can always write down that an arbitrary row is equal to a linear superposition, in this case, of the Pauli operators and the identity. And we've got some sort of coefficients out the front. And so experimentally, what you would like to do is to just determine what those coefficients are. And then you can plug that back into this expression and get the density matrix. So I'll just write that down in matrix notation. And this generalizes to higher dimensional systems. So like for three-dimensional systems, you would have a sum from 0 to 8. And rather than these being Pauli matrices, they would be what are known as Gell-Mann matrices. And you can go, you know, higher and higher. But just so we can see intuitively what's going on. So rho can be decomposed like this. And then to find out what these coefficients A, 1, 2, 3, and so on are, we can just invert the set of equations that you would get for for these coefficients A1 and so on. So we invert and so we find that the coefficients are just given by the expectation values of the Pauli matrices, which is very nice. So A0 is just going to be equal to 1 because it's the expectation value of the identity. But for all of the other values, we just so what you would have is like you have like 1,000 or 1,000,000 copies of this state, and you split it up into three different sections, and so on like 300 of them you measure the expectation value of sigma x, on the other 300 you measure the expectation value of sigma y, and on the last third you measure the expectation value of sigma z, and then the values that you get you just plug them back into this expression for rho. And then you'll be able to write down, this is the density matrix for, the state that I prepared over and over again. And so the technical term for this procedure is called quantum state tomography. And the reason it's called tomography is because tomography is, measuring slices. Let's say in three-dimensional space, you can think about it as, measuring different projections of some three-dimensional object and then reconstructing that entire three-dimensional object from these slices. So that's kind of what happens in, CAT scans or, medical tomography. They, measure different slices through your brain and then they can reconstruct, a three-dimensional image. So in this case, you're measuring projections onto, X, Y, and Z, and from that you can reconstruct the entire dimensional system. So that's all we have for, yes?
We have A naught as
one. Yeah, yep. Yeah, are there any other questions, I guess? Okay, great. So yeah, thank you very much. It was very nice. And I'll see you anyway at the tutorial, so.